Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, featuring Ambassador Dennis Ross. Ambassador Ross's lecture is entitled The Missing Piece, Prospects and Possibilities in the Middle East After Arafat, and inaugurates the Yitzhak Rabin lecture series recently established by the center. Introducing Ambassador Ross tonight is Center Director, Professor Stephen Katz. Professor Katz.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ambassador Dennis Ross. Ambassador Ross has been a prime player in trying to resolve the Middle East crisis for the last 15 years, more. He was an advisor to George Bush Sr., to Bill Clinton, under which there was that very major push to try to create the conditions and the map that would bring the two sides together and bring peace, and has continued to work in the area. He is now a fellow of the Washington Institute, and he's their Ziegler Fellow, a very distinguished scholar of international affairs. He began at UCLA, received his PhD there in Soviet studies while there still was a Soviet Empire. He then went on to head an institute at Stanford University. Then he moved to the National Security Council and has been with in and out of the government, mostly in, for the last 20 years. He now shuttles back and forth between America and the Middle East, continuing his interest and his support for the good guys, trying to make some kind of arrangement that will work and last, and continues to be one of the primary experts on the subject, not only in the United States but around the world. As he said over dinner, you might disagree with him about certain interpretations, but when it comes, for example, to the maps which the Palestinians and the Israelis discussed, he knows the facts because he drew them up. So I think we're very fortunate to have him tonight to come and address us on the subject of the Middle East after Arafat. And without further ado, Dennis Ross.
Thank you. You probably came to hear me talk about the Middle East, and I'm going to do that. I mean, ironically, this is a time that is so characterized by so much that's going on, and it's also characterized by something else. Never since the United States has been a global power has the Middle East been the focal point of our foreign policy, but it is today. The Middle East, broadly defined, between Iraq, Iran, the war on terror, Israeli-Palestinian issue, this is now where the President of the United States will spend most of his time, at least in terms of demands, concerns, responses. And I could have a large array to draw from in terms of what I would talk about. What I'm going to do is talk about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and I'm going to talk about where things stand. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about my book as a way of creating a point of departure. I'm not going to go through what the essence of the book is, because that's not what I want to talk about tonight. But I want to talk about how to think about the conflict. I want to talk about, in a sense, what I was trying to do in the book. This is a book that if you want to understand what are the narratives of each side, what's their story, why do they see the world the way they do, what historical factors shaped it, you'll find it in the book. If you want to understand what were the pressures on each of the leading personalities and the negotiators when they tried to negotiate this, you'll see that too. Every leader bore the weight of history on his shoulders, and you felt it continually. If you want to understand what constrained them, what their hopes were, you'll see it. If you want to understand how close we got, you'll see it, because the fact is we came very close. It's important to know that, because if we're going to be able to reestablish negotiations, we should be able to know what came before. Not solely for understanding all the ins and outs of every issue, because if you want to see how close we came and why we didn't make it and what proposals we made, it's all there. But you can also understand what didn't work and why it didn't work. And you can also see something else. This is a story about how hard it is to do it. It's a story of an emotional roller coaster. It's a story of great personal investment. And if the administration is going to be serious about it, it's an indication of what it takes to be serious about it. You're not serious because you say you're serious. You're serious because you act in a way that reflects your seriousness. And here you'll see what it takes, the kind of political investment, the kind of exposure, the kind of patience, the kind of perseverance, the ability to withstand setbacks and not give up. That's what it takes. That's what you'll see. Now, all those would have been good reasons to write the book. They're not the reasons I wrote the book. They're all there, but they're not the reasons I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I wanted to debunk mythologies, because the Middle East is a region that is characterized by mythologies. And you know what a mythology is? A mythology is an untruth that is repeated over and over and over again so that what is untrue becomes unquestioned, so that what is untrue becomes an indisputable fact, so that what is untrue is somehow a given. And I wanted to point out all the mythologies, especially as they related to the effort to negotiate peace. That's why I have, as Steve said, that's why I put the maps in the book, to actually show what was offered versus what is claimed to have been offered. I wanted to show not only how close we came, I wanted to debunk the mythologies, but I wanted to do something else. This is not a book that is about a sense of loss and perpetual failure. It is a book about hope, because the book is geared towards lessons learned. There's a chapter in the book that is devoted only to lessons from the past. And I'm not going to go through all the lessons tonight. I want to focus on two very small lessons, but nonetheless, they're relevant for today. One is, when you read this book, one of the lessons you're going to see that stands out is that nothing ever implements itself by itself. If you have an understanding, if you produce an understanding, that's the beginning of your work, not the end of your work, because nothing will ever implement itself by itself. And I want to use that as a point of departure for a simple reason, because we have a moment today, but it won't take care of itself. It won't be realized by itself. Another lesson from the book is that whenever you miss a moment in the Middle East, you are always worse off. Always. So I said we have a moment. So why do we have a moment? We have a moment for a number of reasons. First, Yasser Arafat's gone. Yasser Arafat was the impediment to change. He was the impediment to change not only between Israelis and Palestinians, but among Palestinians. As long as Yasser Arafat was there, there was no possibility of a rule of law for Palestinians, an end of corruption for Palestinians, democratization for Palestinians, institutionalization for Palestinians. The basic reform movement was impossible as long as he was there, because the system that he presided over had to be corrupt. He used corruption and the dependency on corruption to preserve his power. Everyone who benefited from it had a stake in preserving the system as it was. There would be no change internally as long as Arafat was there. And you know, it's interesting. Palestinians understand that. And the best indication of it? Yasser Arafat was an icon for the Palestinian people, without question. Why? He put the Palestinian cause on the map. He got for the Palestinians international recognition and acceptance of their national aspirations. And for that, he will always be given credit by the Palestinian people. But a very interesting indicator that reveals what they really thought of him. Here's an icon on the movement, and when he dies, Palestinians suddenly become optimistic about the future. Polling of Palestinians before he was sick showed Palestinians optimistic about the future at between 35 and 40%. And when Arafat died, 60% were optimistic about the future. So what does that tell you? It tells you the Palestinians get it. They understood that he's an icon. They're not going to let anybody else denigrate who he is and what he meant to Palestinians. But they understood he gave them a past and he gave them no future. And he's gone. So the impediment to any change is gone. So that's one reason that there's a moment now. A second reason there's a moment is because the man who replaced him as the head of the Palestinian Authority and the head of the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, whom I call Abu Mazen, believes in internal change, believes in a rule of law, believes in reform, believes in coexistence with Israel, and believes that nonviolence is the only answer. Is he a Palestinian nationalist? Absolutely. Will he be easy to negotiate with on the core issues of Jerusalem and refugees and borders? No, he will not be. He's authentic, and that's who you want. This is a Yitzhak Rabin lecture, and what did Yitzhak Rabin say? You make peace with your enemies. You don't have to make peace with your friends. When you're dealing with your adversaries, you want them to be credible. You want them to be authentic. You want them to be able to deliver. Abu Mazen is a credible Palestinian. And he believes, as I said, in coexistence and nonviolence. He believes that the Palestinians should never sacrifice or surrender their national rights, but the only way to pursue them is through nonviolence and negotiations. So that's the second reason we have a moment, an opportunity. The third reason we have a moment or an opportunity is precisely because Ariel Sharon has made the decision to get out of Gaza and part of the northern part of the West Bank. I make a reference to part of the northern part of the West Bank because it's a small number of settlements, four. Actually, six, depending upon how you count. Their total population is 500. There's not a large number of settlers. But the geographic area that the Israelis would leave is twice the size of Gaza. So they would leave Gaza, including all of its 21 settlements, and they would leave a small part of the West Bank in the north, but that small part in terms of people is one thing. The geographic area is not so small in terms of what it will mean with regard to Palestinians being free of Israelis. Now, he's made that decision. It's generated enormous opposition within Israel. He still has 70% of the Israeli public strongly supporting him, but he has 30% strongly opposed. And that 30% makes up the backbone of his own party. Today, he has a hard time commanding a majority of his own party, even while he commands a majority of the Israeli public. And the Israeli settler movement feels betrayed by him. And there are threats of civil disobedience, and perhaps worse. The Israeli military is focused on how they're going to carry this off, and a great deal of the effort of Shin Bet these days is not geared towards the Palestinians, it's geared towards what they see as potential threats from the far right within Israel. There are assassination threats against Sharon. If you ever see Sharon these days walking, it's hard to see him at all because he's completely encompassed by the Shin Bet wherever he goes because of the threats. It will be a trauma when Israel gets out, but he's determined to carry it out. He's got a national unity government that makes it possible. They passed the budget, which was the last hurdle to being able to do it, meaning hold his government together, and he will, in fact, carry this off. So when he carries it off, it creates an opening. Why? Think about what's going to happen. In the last 4 years, you had a war between Israelis and Palestinians. The Intifada, in Arabic, it means uprising. This was an uprising for a period of time, and it became a war. That's what it's been. It's been a war for the last 4 years. Now, in that four-year period, both sides lost faith in the idea of peacemaking. Israelis became convinced that Palestinians would never accept the Jewish state of Israel and would never give up terror as an instrument to pursue their objective of ridding themselves of the Jewish state of Israel. And the Palestinians became convinced that the Israelis would never surrender control, that they always feel the need to control what the Palestinians do. Now, look at Gaza disengagement and Gaza withdrawal. On the one hand, Palestinians will see, actually, Israelis will give up control. And Palestinians, if they assume their responsibilities and make it clear that they'll fulfill their side of the bargain, as it relates not only to internal good governance, but as it relates to, in fact, ensuring no security threats out of the area they control, then Israelis will see, oh, you know, maybe they can fulfill their side of the bargain. So here is an opportunity to reestablish what is the core bargain after all. I always focused on the formula of land for peace, but that was never the core bargain between Israelis and Palestinians. The core bargain was security for freedom, security for the Israelis, freedom for the Palestinians. Gaza gives you a chance to create a model. And if it's good enough for Gaza, why can't it be applied to the West Bank? That's what Gaza disengagement represents. It represents an opening. So that's the third reason that we have something new to be focused on and to see an opportunity. The fourth reason is that we actually see Egypt playing a much more positive role than it has for the last 11 years. When you read the book, as I'm sure you all will, you'll see there was a reason why Mubarak stopped being helpful in May of 1994. And without going through all of it, the reason was because Arafat put on a show at an event that Mubarak organized to sign what was the first implementing agreement after the Declaration of Principles. This was the agreement that created the Palestinian Authority. This was the agreement that made it possible for Arafat to go back to Gaza. And in front of the world, with the event being televised, and Mubarak, the host, he refused to sign the maps. And he put on a show for a half hour. And in the end, when we got him off the stage, it became clear that this was about nothing. It was about using everybody there as a prop, including Mubarak, including the Secretary of State of the United States, including the Foreign Minister of Russia. They were all props to allow Arafat to show to his public no one would stand up for Palestinian interests the way he would. He'd stand up to the world, even if everyone was against him, for the sake of the Palestinian interests. Arafat was always a defier. Here he was proving no one would struggle for Palestinian interests the way he would. But for Mubarak, it told him, never do I again put myself on the line, create a big event where I'm hostage to what he does. He would do events that we would ask him to do, and there would never be anything afterwards. Now the Egyptians, I can tell you at this point, when the Israelis and the Palestinians had a problem with the initial Israeli withdrawal from Jericho until Karam, it was the Egyptians who intervened, not us, and got it done. Now, are they doing this because suddenly Arafat is gone and they feel they can do this without embarrassment? It's a factor. Is it the only factor? Probably not. Probably there's a desire on the part of Mubarak to show how indispensable he can be on these issues so that we won't push him so hard on internal reform. And probably also there's an interest that when it comes to withdrawal from Gaza, once the Israelis are out of Gaza, guess what? Gaza's next door to Egypt. If everything devolves into chaos and Hamas emerges in Gaza, and Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, well, guess who has a problem? The Egyptians do. So Egypt, for its own reasons, has an interest in doing this. But it creates another factor that is positive, another opening, another reason for an opening. Now, there's another factor, and that's the President of the United States has made it clear that he intends to expend our capital, political capital, to help ensure that this process can work. Not just disengagement, but as he said, to see a Palestinian state emerge during the life of his term. And his Secretary of State, in her first visit as a Secretary of State, went to Europe, but also went and saw the leaders of the Israelis and Palestinians. And I can assure you that if we're going to take advantage of this moment, it will not happen unless the U.S. is very active. So I've just given you the good news. So maybe I should leave right now. The other shoe's about to fall. I'm not optimistic right now. Now, when you read the book, as you all will, when you read the book, you're going to say, this guy must have been congenitally optimistic to be able to do what he continued to do. In fact, when my wife finished reading the draft of the book, she said two things. The first thing she said was, well, at least now I know what you were doing all that time. And the second thing she said was, how did you do it for so long? Didn't you just want to kill all of them? I said, well, yes. But I said, look, I was really committed. I really believe in this. I'm really passionate about it. And, you know, that kind of commitment is really deeply grounded. And she said, how committed were you? I said, I was very committed. She said, you should have been committed. We are at a point where there is a moment, but let me explain why there's a problem. It's not hopeless, but it's going to take the active role of a third party. In fact, the situation cries out for a third party. What's going on? First, the Israelis and the Palestinians today have completely different expectations. The Israelis feel that they are in the process of withdrawing. They have tremendous problems with regard to disengagement. And while there's a ceasefire, which is true, and it's holding, and the attacks are way down, and even the threat alerts are way down, although there are still some threat alerts. The Israeli view is, look, part of our understanding with the Palestinians was they would, in fact, disarm all the fugitives. There's a list of 495 that the Israelis gave to the Palestinians. And the Israeli understanding was that the fugitives would be disarmed, and they would not be allowed to travel outside the cities they're in. They would not be arrested. The assumption and the understanding, to the extent to which there was an understanding, was not that, in fact, there would be an arrest of the fugitives. But the fugitives would be disarmed, they wouldn't be allowed to travel, and that would ensure that they wouldn't be planning attacks. Now, the Israelis have gotten out of two cities. Palestinians told me that once they got out of the cities, that they would act against the fugitives in those two cities, Jericho and Tukaram. Hasn't happened. So the Israelis are saying, because that hasn't happened, we have to go very slow. We know from our previous experience, if these groups are out there, even if they're not carrying out attacks today, they're planning them for tomorrow, and we're not going to wait until we're hit. So the Israelis say, we're not doing anything more in terms of lifting checkpoints. We're not doing anything more in terms of withdrawing from additional cities in the West Bank until we see the Palestinians reorganize their security forces, which hasn't happened. And we also see that the Palestinians will act against the fugitives, at least along the lines that we've described. And the Palestinians say, look, we have a ceasefire. The onus is on the Israelis to take the next step, not us. So you start with two different expectations. The Israelis say, we can't be lifting more checkpoints because they're not acting against fugitives and reorganizing their security forces. And the Palestinians are saying, we don't have to do anything more because we produced a ceasefire. And for us to do more, we need the Israelis to lift checkpoints. So it becomes already a sign that things are changing for the better. So you start with different expectations and the assumption that the onus is on the other side to take the next step. That's point one. Now, what makes that different set of expectations more difficult? The internal realities on each side. Abu Mazen is facing a major conflict within his own faction, Fatah. There's the young guard versus the old guard. And the old guard, basically all the people who are around Arafat, all the people who benefited from corruption, all those that the young guard wants out. Now, the old guard is basically saying, we're not going to go quietly. You move us out, we're going to support Farouk Kaddoumi as the head of the PLO. Now you might say, well, all right, Abu Mazen is the president of the Palestinian Authority. Who cares if Farouk Kaddoumi is the head of the PLO? Well, there's a certain legacy here too. In 1994, at the time of that first implementing agreement that I described, that Arafat didn't want to sign the maps over, well, in that first implementing agreement, one of the things that was understood at Israeli insistence is that the PLO would have standing internationally, not the Palestinian Authority. It would be the PLO that has membership or involvement in international organizations. It would be the PLO that could do agreements with other countries. It was not the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority could only do agreements with Israel. So if Abu Mazen is the head of the PA and Farouk Kaddoumi becomes the head of the PLO, guess who has a standing internationally? Farouk Kaddoumi. So if you're in Abu Mazen's shoes, what are you going to do? You're going to try to finesse the issue of the old guard. But if you're the young guard, you're saying, hey, look, we had to tolerate the old guard when Arafat was here because he was one of them. We want change. We want reform. We want a rule of law. We want to institutionalize our reality and create institutions that mean something. And we're not going to be patient. In fact, the young guard has threatened to produce their own list for the upcoming elections. And when I met with them, I said, you realize, when you have your own list, and then there's another Fatah list, that means when you have the elections, Hamas wins. So here's Abu Mazen, in a situation where he's got to deal with what are factions within his own faction of Fatah, and Hamas is unified, and he's got to somehow manage this. Is he going to be particularly focused on what additional concessions he can be making to the Israelis, at least as they'll be perceived by Palestinians? Not likely. And take Ariel Sharon. Does he feel at this point he needs to be more forward-leaning in terms of what he does vis-a-vis the Palestinians when he's being challenged every day on the withdrawal from Gaza? Not likely. So each side not only has a different expectation that it's really up to the other to do something, they each have their own internal reasons for why they're reluctant to do anything more on their own. And that further compounds the situation. Now let's take this one step further in terms of Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen has to show that his way works. He has to show that nonviolence pays off. He has to show the result of nonviolence is that life gets better. What does life getting better mean? Well, for one thing, it gets better economically. Look at the situation of Palestinians today. In the year 2000, when you'll see in the book how close we came. In the year 2000, the per capita income of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza was $1,800 a year. Not a lot. Today it's 1,000. 4 years of warfare, and they have lost by almost 50% their per capita income. It's declined that much. I mean, think about it. If you go back and look at the statistics of our depression, it doesn't come close to that. It was a 25% loss in per capita income, not nearly a 50% loss. This has been a catastrophe for Palestinians. Expectations were raised when Abu Mazen was elected that things would change, and they would change for the better. You look at the exit polling after the January 9th election, what do you see? You see 84% of the Palestinians who said they voted because they wanted to see good governance and an end to corruption and a rule of law. 81% said they voted because they wanted to see the economy restored and they wanted to go back and have jobs. 78% said they wanted to see the checkpoints, the Israeli checkpoints, lifted. 77% said they wanted to be in a position where you talk to the Israelis again because they realized you couldn't achieve any of that without talking to the Israelis. All of them expected that Abu Mazen would produce change. Why did Palestinians become optimistic after Arafat died? Because they knew there'd be no change as long as he was there. Here's Abu Mazen. They expected he would produce change. Now, what's happened so far? He was elected January 9th. So what's happened so far? Well, because of the problem with the old guard, no move on the corruption front. Because of the problem with the old guard, he also hasn't reorganized the security forces yet. That affects the Israelis. The economy has not improved. You haven't seen a change. People are not going back to work. And there's no significant increase in freedom of movement because the Israelis are approaching the lifting of checkpoints very slowly, grudgingly, because, as they say, all the guys who are the fugitives are the guys who we know are still out there planning attacks. All right, maybe the attacks aren't coming right now. And, in fact, in March, there were no Israeli fatalities from terror. First month since the beginning of the Intifada where that was the case. But I can tell you they still get threat alerts. When I was in Israel, driving within Israel, I was caught up in a two-hour stoppage at an inspection point because the Israelis had gotten a terror alert, and they threw on this block what amounted to a blockage within Israel because this is where they understood the cell that was from the 495 was traveling. So as long as they see a threat out there, they're reluctant to move. And also, as I said, their lessons from the past are, if you don't get the Palestinians to act on these things, they won't do it at all. And they see moving on the checkpoints as being a security need, but also retains leverage on the Palestinians. So here we have a stake in Abu Mazen. He's different. We say we want Abu Mazen to succeed. And I've said the only way Abu Mazen is going to succeed is by showing his way works. And today, what does he have to point to? One of the members of the Palestinian Authority, who is actually a reformer, holds two ministerial positions right now, social affairs and labor. And he said to me, look, we have to compete with Hamas. We, Fatah, have to compete with Hamas. What do we have to show today? Are we relevant on security? No. Are we relevant on policy? No. Are we relevant on economics? No. Are we relevant on social welfare? No. So how are we supposed to compete? Now, obviously, there are things that Abu Mazen is going to have to do on his own, but he also needs help to do it. We are, what, we're 3 months after he's elected? Almost exactly 3 months after he's elected, with very little change. Right now, the polls show that Hamas is gaining, and if the elections are held without a change, Hamas is actually going to win the elections in the Legislative Council. So what happens to this moment that I described? I outlined five factors. Now I've just told you, if things don't change, Hamas is going to win the election. Are we still going to be talking about a moment of opportunity after that happens? Not likely. All right, so now I've given you the bad news. I give you the good news, give you the bad news. I could stop now, but I won't. Because I'm going to tell you what can be done to fix it. This is not irretrievable, but it's pretty clear that nothing is happening when the two sides are left to their own devices right now. And it shouldn't be a surprise. You had 4 years of warfare. There's a legacy from 4 years of warfare. There's a residual degree of suspicion. Each side learns the lessons from the past. What they hear when they talk to each other right now, they hear what's said at one level and they interpret it in another way. They each have their doubts. That's why I said at the outside, it's a situation that cries for third-party involvement. Now look, in the last 4 years when we disengaged, the Europeans tried certain things, the UN tried certain things. What became very clear is nobody else can play a role that is effective other than us. So when I say third party, I mean U.S. All right, so what has to be done? I'm going to give you the list of things that I think have to be done. First, we have to cement and secure the ceasefire. There is a ceasefire. I said no Israeli fatalities in the last month from terror. But the ceasefire is not defined. When I was just out there and I asked each side to define it for me, and specifically I said, tell me what's a violation. I didn't get a clear answer. So then I said, all right, let's assume there's a violation. What happens? What I heard on the Israeli side was, the Palestinians know we will act if they don't. So I said, well, what kind of action do you expect by the Palestinians? It was a little bit like the Justice Stewart definition of pornography. We'll know it when we see it. So I said, and if they don't act and you act, do the Palestinians know what you'll do? Well, they can imagine it. Well, I can tell you, it doesn't work that way. You want the ceasefire to hold, we better define what's permitted and what isn't. Today, Hamas, I can tell you, in Gaza, is testing longer-range Qassam rockets. They have these indigenously made Qassam rockets, very primitive, not very accurate, not much range, and right now they're test-firing them to increase the range and the accuracy. Now, how long do you think the Israelis are going to wait to watch that before they do something? Not real long. So, first of all, define what's permitted and what isn't permitted. Secondly, determine what happens if there's a violation. What are the Palestinians supposed to do? What's the response mechanism? What do the two sides do together in the event of a violation? We have a security coordinator out there, General William Ward, named by the Secretary of State. Right now, his mission is not defined. And so he doesn't interact very often with the two sides. If you're going to have a security coordinator, he needs to start coordinating security. The place to start is to define what the ceasefire is, come up with common response mechanisms if there's a violation. Now, he needs to do more than that. Part of his charter was to help the Palestinians with the reform process, the overhaul of their security forces. When Arafat was there, he created 14 security organizations, 14. And their role in life was to compete with each other to preserve him in power. It wasn't to create a rule of law. In fact, how could there be a rule of law? You know how they were paid? Anybody have a guess of how they were paid? All in cash. In bags. In cash. That's how they were paid. Pretty good accounting system, don't you think? And the leaders were paid that way, and who knew what they paid the people around them? So all of this was designed to preserve Arafat. 2 years ago, at the time when Abu Mazen was the prime minister, at that time it was agreed there would be a reorganization and the 14 would be reduced to 3. Arafat blocked it. Arafat's not there any longer. They still haven't done it. Again, it's caught up in the intra-Fatah problem. But it has to be dealt with. Now, how can it be dealt with? One thing Abu Mazen needs is help from the outside. He needs a public explanation of why he has to do this. One thing that would make it a lot easier for him is if General Ward, who is a professional military man and is respected as such, and I can tell you the Palestinian security officials have always wanted to be seen as being professional, so it's good to have a professional military man create standards for them. He needs to work with them on what the plan is. When I was there, I was told what the plan was. Okay, you got a plan. What are you going to do to translate it into reality? And you have a reason to begin to work much more intensively because, in fact, Abu Mazen is going to come to see President Bush after Sharon is here. So use his visit as an action-forcing event and create a timeline related to that. General Ward needs to sit with the Palestinian security people every day and focus on where are you today as opposed to yesterday in terms of carrying out this plan. So he needs to sit with both sides in defining the ceasefire, and he needs to sit with the Palestinians in terms of carrying out the reorganization. Where did I start? I said, one critical lesson from the past that is unmistakable, nothing implements itself by itself. There's a security plan out there, and if we don't do anything, it'll be out there a year from now. All right, so item number one, activate your security coordinator both for the ceasefire and for security reorganization. And you have him do one other thing as well. Talk to the Israelis and say, all right, what is it that you have to see in the Palestinian side to be able to lift the checkpoints? And then talk with the Palestinians and say, this is what the Israelis say they need. Find out from the Palestinians what they can do and what they can't do. Where there's a gap between what they can do and what they need to do, let's figure out a way to fill the gap. That's item number one. It's really three items in one. Item number two. Right now, Abu Mazen, as I said, has inherited what amounts to not only a corrupt but a largely inept administrative structure. We should go ahead with the EU and the World Bank and put together a team of people who will go in, sit in Abu Mazen's office, and assist him in terms of carrying out an administrative overhaul. Create a number of people who can be troubleshooters, who can identify problems within the Palestinian Authority, impediments to any change, and have them work with the outsiders to figure out the best ways to overcome those problems. One of the things they need is administrative help. I actually had some of the Palestinians who are making an effort say, could we send people over? Could you find private groups who can, for a 4 to 6 week period, help us in terms of doing administrative training? Bear in mind what I said. Arafat depended upon an administration that was not only corrupt but inept, because people who were there out of loyalty, not because they could do things. Now, if you're going to try to change this, one of the ways you change it is by bringing in those who can help create new administrative models and help identify those who can carry it out. So that's the second item. The third item, we have got to find a way to produce quickly, meaningfully on the ground from an economic standpoint. I said you have a situation where per capita income has dropped dramatically. 40% of those who live on the West Bank today live on less than $2 a day. 60% of those in Gaza live on less than $2 a day. They need jobs. They need labor-intensive projects. Palestinians were the backbone of the construction industry in Israel. Now, when I was in Gaza, what did I see? I saw something called the Sheikh Zayed Township. $55 million provided by the UAE. In a 30-month period, when there was nothing, you went from nothing to 736 apartments. 12 five-story buildings, one 12-story building, the largest mosque in Gaza, a modern school, a recreation area, an integrated infrastructure of sewage, water, and electricity, all done. $55 million, the architecture done by Palestinians. The contractors, Palestinians. The builders, Palestinian. You know, we have $1.2 billion in pledges from the outside world. $440 million of that is from the Arabs. And you know what? It's just sitting right now. And if you want to make a difference right now, I mean, we have pledged $350 million. We don't have it through the Hill yet. $200 million of that is supposed to be in a supplemental. If assuming we get it through within the next month, when do you think it's actually going to materialize on the ground? They'll feel it maybe in 6 to 12 months. Abu Mazen doesn't have 6 to 12 months. So if we have all these pledges of assistance, especially from the oil-rich Arab countries who are experiencing a continuing windfall of oil revenue, I mean, at a stunning level, all you got to do is every time you go to the pump, just think about who's getting it. I've said this on a number of occasions. I continue to say it. I'm not greedy. I want them to give 1% of their oil windfall revenues to the Palestinians. You imagine what 1% would do? You could build about 10 of the Sheikh Zayed townships. You could do one thing that Abu Mazen wants to do to solve the security problem. You know what he wants to do? He wants to pension off all those who basically are an impediment to any change in the security forces as a way of doing the reorganization. Well, you know who could pay for those pensions right now? Saudis could pay for those pensions right now. I want the Palestinian Authority to be the one who can provide social welfare, a social safety net. Hamas does that today. So The third item has to be making a difference on the ground so Palestinians feel it. Abu Mazen can buy time if people begin to see that they're going back to work. Fourth item is we have to do something about Hezbollah and Iran. Every Palestinian I just spoke to said the greatest single threat to what Abu Mazen is trying to do in terms of preserving the calm, and even to him personally, is coming from Hezbollah and Iran. Now, Hezbollah has its own set of concerns today within Lebanon. Assuming Syria gets out, and I think they'll get out in one way, I'm not entirely sure they're going to get out in another way, but assuming Syria gets out of Lebanon, which they now say they'll do before the end of the month, Hezbollah's in a position where they have to decide, are they Lebanese, or are they supporting the Syrians, or are they supporting the Iranians? We need to put a spotlight on this, and actually the French, who have an enormous historical tie, emotional tie, psychological tie to the Lebanese, they're the best ones to highlight this, but we ought to make it part of our policy so that what happens in Lebanon right now has got to be governed by those who are trying to shape a Lebanese future. If Hezbollah is going to subvert what's going on between Israelis and Palestinians, they may well trigger some responses that are not so good for Lebanon. We need to highlight that. We need the French involved with us as we highlight it. But we also need to do it with the Iranians. Look, we at this point are now coordinating with the British, the French, and the Germans on their negotiations with the Iranians. Now, those negotiations are about trying to turn a temporary suspension of enrichment activities into a permanent suspension of enrichment activities. Tony Blair, when he came to see the president right after the election, Tony Blair said, the most important issue in the world is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. If it's the most important issue in the world and he's involved in a negotiation with the Iranians and the Iranians are the ones who are trying to subvert it, well, it ought to be a centerpiece of their discussions. And the Iranians ought to understand that if they deny any involvement, no one buys it. And if they want technological benefits, economic benefits, and political benefits, which they do, they're not getting them unless this is also part of the behavior that changes on their part. So we have to coordinate. We're coordinating anyway in those negotiations. Let's raise this as an issue, not to be dealt with a year or two from now, but now. Now, a fifth item is the Arabs. We've now lost two opportunities to affect the situation. I talked before about the importance of affecting the reality on the ground. There was a London conference, and the London conference was in March. In December, I made a reference to $1.2 billion being pledged to the Palestinians. The London conference, which should have been a place where those pledges were acted on, became a place where those pledges were repeated. The London conference should have been about financing specific commitments. Getting it on the ground now became another opportunity to give speeches about how important it was to help the Palestinians. Unfortunately, nothing was done to help the Palestinians. That was an opportunity lost. We had an Arab summit. That was another opportunity lost. At the Arab summit, we should have had Arab leaders embrace what Abu Mazen is doing. We should have had them for the first time embrace his words. He says we can't achieve our ends through violence. He says we have to have a ceasefire. He says we won't surrender our rights, but we'll only achieve them through negotiations and nonviolence. There should have been a declaration from the Arab summit on that. We should have put our effort into that. Instead, there was an effort that failed to create greater normalization with Israel. I'm not against greater normalization with Israel. In fact, when you talk about roadmaps, there should be a roadmap of normalization for the Arab states. What are they going to do and when are they going to do it? But the most important immediate need is how do you build Abu Mazen's legitimacy and how do you raise the cost to Hamas and others from defecting from the ceasefire? And if the Arab world were to get behind it and legitimize it, you would do both. So just because we lost the opportunity of the Arab summit doesn't mean we shouldn't be making the effort right now. We should. All right, the sixth and last item, and here there are two parts, is what we do beyond what General Ward does. I started by talking about the significance of the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, the disengagement from the northern part of the West Bank. I talked about how important it is to have that work. Today, there isn't coordination between Israelis and Palestinians. How are you going to make it work if there isn't coordination? We have to get into this. One of the reasons there's been a reluctance is because there's a division again on the Palestinian side. Abu'llah has said, he's the prime minister, he said, look, this is an Israeli decision to withdraw, let them withdraw. Well, there's a little bit of a problem there. There are 21 settlements. What happens to the infrastructure there? There's an infrastructure with greenhouses. There's an infrastructure with housing. There's an agribusiness beyond the greenhouses. There's underground pipes and sewage. So what happens to it? Is it just going to magically take care of itself? No, it's not. You're going to have to coordinate. Now, if there's a reluctance, not so much any longer, I think, on Abu Mazen's part, but there still is a problem that has to be managed. It isn't going to happen with the Aspen Institute doing it. That's a nice symbol. It's going to happen because we sit with both sides and say, let's work out the process of coordination. So we have to get into this game. We have to be active. And again, look at where we are. We're now in April. The Israeli withdrawal is going to take place in July. The clock is ticking. It didn't happen up until now. Unless we get involved, it isn't going to happen. So we are going to have to be much more involved than we've been. The president has said he's going to expend political capital. The Secretary of State went there. We are going to have someone working this issue on a daily basis and out there. That's one thing that we have to do. There's a second thing we have to do. We have to create a bridge to the future. You know, if you have, how many people here have heard of the roadmap to peace? How many people here think it's a roadmap to peace? Not too many people here think it's a roadmap to peace. Now, the fact of the matter is, the roadmap is a good umbrella. Today, the roadmap is a list of slogans. 52 paragraphs in which you have a list of slogans. Why do I say a list of slogans? Because there isn't a single obligation in the roadmap that is understood the same way by the two sides. Because the roadmap was negotiated with the EU, by us, with the EU, the Russians, and the UN. And it wasn't negotiated with those who actually had to carry it out. That's not the worst part of it. The Secretary of State, in an interview with the Washington Post, said, "We are trying to determine what a settlement freeze means." It's a very honest answer. I want to quote for you an obligation from the roadmap that we negotiated. It says, a freeze on all settlement activity, including natural growth. That's an exact quote. Now, do you think that the Palestinians have a doubt on how they define that? Do you think the Europeans have a doubt on how they define that, or the Russians or the UN? We have to determine what it means. The Israelis certainly have a very different definition of what it would mean from the Palestinians. What I'm highlighting is nothing in the roadmap has any definition. So how can the roadmap to peace be a roadmap to peace if there's no definition in it? Now, does that mean it's hopeless? No, it doesn't. And you know why we should focus on it and why it can be the bridge to the future? Because Ariel Sharon, when he received the April 14th letter from last year, insisted in the drafting of it that the president commit to saying the United States would not support any initiative other than the roadmap. And Abu Mazen at the Sharm el-Sheikh summit with Sharon said he saw this as reactivating the roadmap. The roadmap is something that is politically useful for both sides. It is the only agreed political framework that is out there. So make a virtue of necessity. And we can launch a negotiating process based on that. We should be right now coordinating the disengagement. And we should make it clear that we will also be prepared to work with the two sides to come up with a definition on every single item there. Will it be an easy negotiation? Absolutely not. That's the reason we didn't do it with them in the first place. But I got news for you. Diplomacy ain't easy. And when you read the book, as you all will, when you read the book, you're going to see what it takes. That's why I talked about what an emotional roller coaster. That's why I said, you have to live with the fact that it's hard. You have to live with the fact that you're going to have setbacks. You have to live with the frustration. But if you are committed to it, if you believe in it, you do it. If it is a priority, then you don't just say it's a priority. You act in a way that demonstrates it's a priority. Now, I'm telling you, if we don't act in a way that demonstrates it's a priority, we are going to lose the moment. And if we lose the moment, it will be 10 years before we have another one. Now, what do you think is going to happen in that 10 years? Do you think everything is just going to be static? You think it'll just remain as it is? One of the reasons it's so hard now, we're not talking about making peace, we're talking about ending a war, is because of the last 4 years. Why do the Fatah Younger Guard want change so much? Why do they want to end the war so much? Why do they want coexistence so much? Because they tell me the next generation after them looks at Al-Qaeda as their model after 4 years of war. Take 10 years of a continuation of what we've seen, and we will find the situation so far much worse than it is today that it'll be hard, in fact, to describe it. So if I come back next year to speak here, we'll see whether we've acted on my 6 items of recommendation or something that is the equivalent of that. Because if we don't, we're going to find it's a long time coming before we have another time we can speak about opportunity.
You've been listening to a lecture entitled The Missing Piece, Prospects and Possibilities in the Middle East After Arafat, by Ambassador Dennis Ross. Sponsored by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, this lecture marked the beginning of the Yitzhak Rabin lecture series recently established by the center. Introducing Ambassador Ross tonight was Center Director Professor Stephen Katz. For a CD or a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.